afternoon, everyone. We have two presentations today, and then when we're done, we will likely, if the paperwork is done, introduce some committee measures. So let's begin with a look at the changing world of tax expenditures by John Hart from the Oregon Department of Revenue. Welcome, Mr. Hart.
Thank you.
Yes, members of the committee, thank you for having me here to talk about our 2019-21 biennial tax expenditure report. Today, I want to do a kind of brief overview of the tax expenditure report, some of the changes that are there, some of the kind of high-level descriptive information, and then a look at an emerging issue with the tax expenditure report and our definition of tax expenditures. Starting off, the tax expenditure report was first created in 1996 based on the Budget Accountability Act of 1995. The idea being that programs that are implemented through the tax code that subsidize certain activities or provide incentives to certain activities are similar to direct expenditures, and that those should be debated in conjunction with the online budgets, so kind of on the same level as spending for the different policy areas. The Act and the statute requires certain elements be included in the tax expenditure report, including the statutory authority for each tax expenditure, the estimate of revenue loss associated with the tax expenditure, the purpose of the tax expenditure. We actually have we have gotten better at this, but the purpose for some of the federal provisions, for instance, isn't always explicit, and so we find ourselves creating a purpose that seems rational given the tax expenditure. The report is required to have a list of who directly benefits, not a list, a description of who directly benefits from the tax expenditure, and an evaluation. And program agencies that handle programs similar to the purpose of the tax expenditure do those evaluations. The Act also requires that the expenditures be categorized based on budget programs or functions. And in addition, at the front of the book, you'll find a list of sunset recommendations from the governor as to whether to extend provisions that are expiring or that have a partial sunset. The Department of Revenue's role in creating the tax expenditure report is to identify new, modified, or deleted tax expenditures. These include changes in federal law or changes in state law. Sunsets would be things that are generally set that have a timing for deletion of tax expenditures that we identify. We write the descriptions for the tax expenditures. For the tax expenditures that result from federal law, we borrow heavily from the Congressional Research Service. They have a publication that comes out every 2 years, the Compendium of Tax Expenditures. That's a very good resource. And we produce the estimates of revenue loss for most of the tax expenditures in the book. Some of the ones that we don't, for instance, include those that are for the Highway Fund. The Department of Transportation produces the estimates of revenue loss for those. We work with agencies to collect data on use. We find out things like the number of acres devoted to growing commercial shellfish. And we use that to describe who benefits and what the revenue loss is. And we also facilitate the evaluations by the agencies. There's a lot of work that goes into this with respect to the budget. We coordinate with DASA's Chief Financial Office and with the Legislative Revenue Office to make sure we're on the same page for things like the cost to extend sunsets, and with the Governor's Office for the sunset recommendations. Our definition of tax expenditure is somewhat unique. And I can read this verbatim so that I don't misstate it. But our definition of tax expenditure is any law of the federal government or this state that exempts in whole or in part certain persons, income, goods, services, or property from the impact of established taxes, including but not limited to tax deductions, tax exclusions, tax subtractions, tax exemptions, tax deferrals, preferential tax rates, and tax credits. And later in the presentation, we'll talk about how this is a, I think, perfectly reasonable definition if we're using it to decide what provisions are included in the tax expenditure report. But it becomes a little bit problematic when we start using this definition for things that have administrative consequences. Since the report is required because tax expenditures are similar to direct spending, it's worth noting that some tax expenditures are more similar to direct spending than other tax expenditures. Those things that are incentives to encourage certain activities or financial assistance for certain taxpayers are very much like direct spending. These things, like the mortgage interest deduction, could be replaced with a check that the state writes to people who have mortgage interest to offset some of that mortgage interest. But there are things that we use tax expenditures for that simplify compliance or tax administration, and there are provisions that are prohibited by federal law, and those are really not like direct spending, or not as much like direct spending. So something like allowing small businesses to use cash-based accounting instead of accrual accounting is there to simplify compliance for those small businesses for the most part. And a lot of provisions actually have elements of more than one of these characteristics. They can be both an incentive and they can simplify. Our tax expenditure report this year has 18 chapters. We use one chapter for each tax program, combining corporate and personal income taxes into chapter one. Chapters 17 and 18 are new this year for the vehicle use and privilege taxes. Even in a leap year, we couldn't have a calendar that covered every tax expenditure if we did one a day. We now have 368. And the majority of those are from the income tax program or property tax. There's 190 for the income tax programs and 134 for property tax. Included in our book every year is a table that sums up the tax expenditures and compares them to the revenues of the related programs. You'll see the footnote here, and I think at least a paragraph in our report say don't sum these up because it doesn't mean what you think it means. But we know people like to see these summed up for comparison, so we do it to kind of get ahead of that. We know we'd be asked for this anyway. One of the reasons these sums don't mean what you think they mean is because, for instance, if a taxpayer has a $100 tax liability and they have two credits that are each $100, they eliminate their tax liability with $100 of credits, but we don't know which one of those credits it came from. And so really, if you repealed either of those credits, tax liability wouldn't change. But if you repealed both of those credits, the tax liability would increase by $100. And so the addition of the impact of those two credits is actually less than the impact of repealing both credits. Sorry to get a little bit heavy there for a second.
Senator Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've always thought this chart was confusing if one looked at it for very long, and probably it's no reason to call out the obvious, but I'm gonna do it again anyway. The 20,187, tell me what that is again.
Okay. Chair Hess, Senator, we have here dollars and millions. So we have estimated revenues for the 1921 biennium for the personal and corporate income taxes of $20.18 billion or 19.
And the 190.
The 190 is the number of tax expenditures that relate to the personal and corporate income taxes.
Mr. Chair, follow up. So the income is there from personal and corporate in Oregon, and we have the ability to determine how much that number is. But if you drop down on the federal exclusions, that's got nothing to do with us. That's the federal government saying, and I know that's in the definition, it says that it's either the state or the feds can create a expenditure. But to call it out and as though it is a comparison to our income tax is a little disingenuous. And I've pointed this out before and said, hey, what the heck? Why are we not calling out all, why don't we set up all the federal tax there also so that we're having an apples and apples sort of comparison? So anyway, I just call that out because I kind of want your thinking on it because you weren't the person I asked this question of on the House side 8 years ago.
Chair Hess, Senator, the federal exclusions includes income that is excluded from the Oregon income tax because it is excluded from the definition of federal taxable income, which is our starting place for the Oregon income tax. So an example might be the employer-provided health care is excluded from the definition of Oregon taxable income because it's excluded from the definition of federal taxable income. Oregon could actually disconnect from that provision and require Oregon taxable income to include employer-provided health care. Probably not a policy anyone's considering, but it is an exclusion that we could actually include an Oregon taxable income. And there's, we have 64 of those exclusions and we have the book sorted starting with the federal exclusions. So workers' compensation benefits is another exclusion that's not in federal taxable income and therefore not in Oregon taxable income, but Oregon could change the law to include it. Again, I don't think anyone's proposing that, but the law requires that since it's a federal law that excludes that we tie to, that excludes that income from Oregon taxable income, that we include this in the book.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I know it's a different answer than 8 years ago, but I think it's a better answer.
Thank you.
Exclusions, deductions, subtractions, credits, you know, I don't know what could be confusing about it. Lumping these together. So. Thank you. Go ahead, John.
Okay. Notable changes for the 1921 biennial edition. We did have a significant tax law pass at the end of 2017. I think throughout our report we call it the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act because its official name is too long to actually put in the book. And just calling it the 2017 Tax Act didn't seem right. But it changed a lot at the federal level. It changed rates for personal and corporate taxes. It placed a limit on the deduction for state and local taxes. It changes the taxation of international corporations significantly and increased depreciation, expensing, and allowances. I believe your staff has presented on this topic more than once, but happy to take questions if you have any. Appendix D lists the new and expired tax expenditures that have been added to the book or have been removed from the book based on their expiration or something else, like in some cases our interpretation of what a tax expenditure has changed, and so we removed a few things from the book. And for a comparison of how much the largest tax expenditures add to the totals, we have here the top 10 personal and corporate income tax expenditures. And those top 10 represent 70%. If you add these up like we say you shouldn't, these are 70% of the total impact. The three there that are shaded, I think that's in blue, are the ones that are actually in Oregon law, and the rest are due to our connection to the definition of federal taxable income. On the definition of tax expenditures, again, I think a lot of people have said in the past that our personal exemption credit, because it applies to everybody, may not be a tax expenditure. It may be part of the tax base. But we include things in the report to be complete, even if they haven't met the definition. The top 10 tax expenditures for property taxes comprise an even larger share of the total if you add them up. These top 10 are 89% of the total. And I apologize for cutting off toward the bottom charitable, literary, and scientific organizations.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hass. Going back to the slide on the top 10 expenditures for personal and corporate income taxes, yesterday we had the hearing on the estate tax, and I just wanted to have you, this says the capital gains on inherited property, that is meaning that it's sold in an estate and then is subject to a, can you just explain that a little bit to me, please?
Chair Hass, Senator, the capital gains on inherited property refers to the step up in basis for inherited property. When a decedent passes along property, the person who inherits that property gets the capital basis in that property at the time of death, essentially. There's some rules around that, but they get a step up on that, and
regardless of who inherits it, I mean, is it a spouse or just anybody who inherits it?
Chair Hass, Senator, I'm not entirely sure about that. It's usually family members.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not entirely sure. There was a point, I think it was 2010, where the federal estate tax went away, and I think that that inheritors had the option of getting the step up in basis or paying an estate tax at the federal level, because those two things are kind of substitutes.
Right. Interesting. Okay, I was just trying to understand. Thank you. Of course.
Since we're stopped here, ask you now on the next slide. I think this brings us to a point that's becoming apparent here. State and local property, we are never going to tax them. So why is it continued to be called an expenditure?
Chair Hass, that's a good question. That's based on our definition of tax expenditure. I think I have that here a few slides down. It is a law of the state that exempts those things from taxation. And so it is certainly not a provision that is like direct spending in the way that other things are. But you could tax local property and then provide a check back to the taxing districts or back to the local governments that you taxed. So it is a thing that could be replaced by a direct spending program, which is what the report is trying to get at. Whether that's a good idea or not is not really part of our considerations when we include it in the book.
So I think this gets on, there's a bill that's been drafted that would attempt to or suggest changing this definition. And this has been an issue with the report since its creation. The Department of Revenue has to abide by statute in creating the report, and they don't have leeway to decide, you know what, we're never going to tax this, so let's not include it in the report. And I think as John talks a little bit more, there are a lot of tentacles to that issue, but there's a bill drafted to put before the committee and then the legislature. Maybe that definition should be changed to make the information that's in the report a little more realistic in terms of what the legislature may actually change or not change.
So I have a problem with that in itself, in that the Department of Revenue can't determine what the legislature may or may not tax.
That's why everything is included
right.
in the book.
Exactly.
Right.
And should be, in my opinion.
Well, if we're never going to...
We don't know that, Mr. Chair.
However... Chair Hass, I mean, I would say, I mean, I understand what you're saying, Senator Riley. However, could it be that if we were to change the definition, say, as long as the piece of property is owned by the state or a local entity, it will not be subject to tax and therefore not included? I mean, as long as it's that. And then if it changes, then it changes. But it would make it much more, I don't know, what shall we say, user-friendly. Because the numbers get so large, they sound so big. And
And
that causes people to think that there's all these things, and they're not really realistic options. They're not.
And that's been the battle cry for years. People take that expenditure book and say, you've got $8 billion in tax breaks here. Cut those down before you, raise taxes. Well, those are tax breaks to churches, which we're probably never going to tax, or local government. We're not going to tax government buildings does create a little bit of a distorted picture unless we adjust the definition.
You put a little star beside it and say this is probably never going to be changed, but theoretically it could be. And that's my rub is we do have the option. It's not politically viable, but we certainly have the option of putting in a bill to change any one of these expenditures. And therefore they are the real definition of a tax expenditure. I mean, a tax expenditure is by definition something that we could tax, but we've decided not to.
Would you appreciate us debating this in the middle of your presentation?
Mr. Chair, this segues perfectly into my next topic, so thank you. We actually have an emerging issue on the definition of tax expenditures, because in 2013, a bill that was relating to tax expenditures added a section to ORS 315.037 that says any tax expenditure as defined for inclusion in the report that is enacted on or after January 1, 2014 has a six-year sunset on that tax expenditure. And so while we've been using a definition that works reasonably well for whether to include something in the book or not, this inclusion of an administrative function associated with that definition has created an issue that may affect taxpayers. We don't know, for instance, what the phrase established tax means. Established tax isn't defined anywhere by itself in statute. And so you could think of a couple criteria that you might use to define established tax. You could think of objective criteria, like the tax is established at the time the tax is enacted. That's not super satisfactory, because you could say create a nuclear energy tax and then exempt Montgomery Burns, who owns the nuclear plant in Springfield. And that would be, I think, most people's definition of a tax expenditure. And so that kind of objective criteria isn't always satisfactory. You could think of the established tax, and I think we usually think of it this way, as the language itself creates the established tax. And so if there's something that's explicitly exempt, unless there's a reason to think otherwise, we think that it's a tax expenditure. And that also is not satisfactory all the time, because there are things that are explicitly exempt or explicit deductions, like business expenses, that we think are not intended to be included in an income tax base because it's net income. And then if you use subjective criteria, you almost have to use subjective criteria. That's going to work out reasonably well for whether you include it in a report or not, but it's not going to be super satisfactory for whether it has a sunset.
Some of these things that will start sunsetting. That's what you're really saying.
Mr. Chair, I think we have several sunsets this biennium, and then we have an example from the vehicle privilege tax passed in 17 that says we have exempt sales for a purchaser who is not a resident of the state or a business if the primary use will be outside the state. And we're not sure exactly what to think the established tax is in this case. If this was a reporting question, we would definitely include this in the book for reporting purposes. But when we add the sunset, then we're starting to affect taxpayers potentially. And so you'll see, I think we have three cases in the book now, and this is our tax expenditure 18.003, where we actually spell out that there's some ambiguity as to whether this is a tax expenditure that meets the definition or not. And that come 2023, this may or may not sunset. Certainly it's something the Department of Revenue will need to know by 2024, and we would get clarity on that by then. But right now, this may or may not meet that definition, because if you use the objective criteria of was this established when the tax was established, yes, it was. But if you look deeper into the statute on this one, this is actually an exempt sale. The taxable entity is the entity selling the motor vehicle. And then we use some pretty different criteria for out-of-state sales. A purchaser who's not a resident, or a business that's going to use the vehicle outside the state. And so it doesn't seem like there's a theme there, that we're not exempting use outside the state, we're exempting non-residents in one case, and in the other case we're not exempting non-resident businesses, we're exempting use outside the state. And so it's hard to think of an objective criteria that kind of answers the question whether this is a tax expenditure.
Sure, Riley. So in that example, if that law didn't exist, would there be a tax?
If Mr. Chair, Senator, if this exemption didn't exist, there would still be a tax.
Okay, it belongs in the book. Thank you.
And my apologies for jumping around a bit, but I think that was a helpful discussion. We have tried to come up with a list of factors that weigh toward the inclusion in the report or weigh toward exclusion in the report. And these factors are not complete. We're trying to be objective, but this is like classifying an independent contractor. There's some things you consider, but you don't have a perfect checklist that says yes, independent contractor, or no, not independent contractor. And so a couple of the things that weigh toward inclusion of the report is one, that it's something that's reflected on a tax return or not reflected on a tax return in the case of exclusions. Two, that it's preferential, that it doesn't apply to everybody equally. Three is that it's really a reduction in taxes. It's not a reduction in fees or penalties or interest. It's taxes. So if we waive state parks admission for foster children, that's not a tax expenditure because that's not a tax. So we don't include those things. And the last one, we treat the federal stuff a little differently, and this gets a little bit toward what Senator Bentz was asking about. We rely on the Joint Committee on Taxation to identify tax expenditures that are in the definition of federal taxable income. And for the most part, if they think it's a tax expenditure, we do. They've, since about 2008, we've drifted apart a little bit, but we rely on them for the most part. Factors that we use that weigh toward excluding tax expenditures or provisions, they're not tax expenditures, excluding provisions from the report are things that apply to everybody equally. So the standard deduction is not a tax expenditure. The Joint Committee on Taxation thinks of the federal standard deduction as a 0% tax bracket or an extension of a 0% tax bracket, and we think the same way. Measures 5 and 50 apply to everyone equally in the property tax system, equally but maybe arbitrarily. The second factor that weighs against including a provision in the book is if it's if it is an exclusion that's implemented when the base is created, we take that into account and we think about whether it's trying to define the base. And right up until the last month before we published this book, we had a chapter for the bike tax. We took that chapter out because we used this factor to determine that the exclusion of durable medical equipment was helping to define the base of what a bicycle is. Our law that defines a bicycle for the bike tax says it's a vehicle that operates on the ground with wheels and it's driven by human power. And wheelchairs would be included in that definition without an exemption. We think because the wheelchair exemption was passed at the same time, and it really does seem to be helping to refine the definition of a bicycle, that that's not a tax expenditure to be included in the book. And the last thing we think of weighing against inclusion of a provision is if it's a subtraction of ordinary and necessary expenses in a business that operates for profit. After hearing some discussion about gambling losses, I would expand this to say that we don't include provisions generally where the expense was seeking some kind of income, because gambling losses are not included in our book as a tax expenditure, because that gambling is, even though Oregon state law says the lottery is for entertainment, the gambling is often seeking income and those expenses. Margin interest, if you take a loan to make an investment, that is deductible because you're seeking income with that loan. And the gambling losses are more similar to that than I would have thought before Monday or Tuesday.
Excuse me, John, in your example of the bicycle and the wheelchair, are you saying that in 6 years that will sunset and now all of a sudden we're going to start taxing bicycles and wheelchairs?
Mr. Chair, that would have been, I think, more of a possibility had we included it in the book, but we excluded it from the book this time, thinking that it was a refinement in the definition of the tax base to exclude wheelchair from the definition of bicycle.
But that's the kind of scenario.
Yeah. That is a fairly subjective judgment. Okay, and with that, I conclude. If I'll take any questions that remain.
Thanks. These books are out. They came out a month or so ago with the governor's budget. They're very interesting reading. Maybe just interesting to me, but and Cliff.
So, if I may, my first three elections, I carried a tax expenditure book with me to every event that I went to, along with the revenue book, and I've studied tax expenditures very carefully for a long time, and in my opinion, and it's of course just my opinion, anything that we could tax, except for an exemption in the law, is a tax expenditure. That's really the core definition of a tax expenditure is, except for this law, this would be taxed.
Okay. That's a way to look at it.
Right. It's the core definition.
So part of the discussion, or from a different perspective, the issue gets at the legislature's ability to define the tax base.
Right.
And depending on how the language makes it into statute, people can interpret that differently. And then we do have physical books if members would like those.
Okay, sir, thank you. Kyle, tax credits.
Okay. Okay, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, continuing the discussion a bit related to tax expenditures, what I have for you today is just sort of an update or a review, so to speak, related to the tax credit report that the Legislative Revenue Office is required to prepare and put out during the long odd year session. So there are two documents in OLS I was going to call your attention to in the media materials. The first is the full report, tax credit report 2019. And then the shorter document that I'll be working from today is just the tax credit review. So I'll pull that up. In terms of what I have, again, I wasn't planning to go through the entire report today. It is a report on the, just as a reminder, it's a report on the tax credits that are set to sunset in the upcoming biennium. So we have 9 tax credits that are set to sunset that are contained within the report. And what I had today a little bit was just to give a quick overview of the report, what's contained within it, and somewhat discussion of the process of reviewing these tax credits. And then I'll finish again with the numbers of the cost to extend and what the revenue implications are related to these tax credits. So the first couple of slides I had were general background on tax expenditures. I think that's pretty well covered from John's discussion from the Department of Revenue, so I'll skip through that. Again, there's statutory requirements that require this tax credit report. Those are up there on the screen, ORS 315-051. And then we also have another statute I'd call your attention to is 315-044, which is a requirement of statement of purpose. So that requires that a proposed tax credit or an expansion of a tax credit would include a statement of purpose provided by the chief sponsor or proponent of the measure. So that's something that was added in statute as well. And that's really key, especially with, you'll see in the tax credit report, is the basis for doing any analysis on a tax credit on whether it's achieving its purpose or doing what it's intended to do really starts with defining the purpose to begin with. And that's, of course, some of the difficulty. And part of the reason I think this report exists is to look into that background. And what we do in the report is to actually comb through the documents and go back and listen to the testimony that was presented to try to get a sense of why was this credit created in the first place, and then any changes that have happened in later sessions, what was the purpose, what was the reasons discussed at that time, and then we put all that information together in the report to give a sense to the reader of what is the actual purpose of this tax credit, and then we go from there to evaluate how effective is it? Is it achieving its goals? And so on and so forth. So in terms of the past tax credit legislative review process, again, this is a review for the members of this committee. But just as a reminder, the general stages, you have the interim process, and that's in a lot of cases just preparing the information. And that's part of this tax credit report reflects the interim process. The policy committee process. So what we have related to each of these tax credits is there is a standard 6-year sunset extension bill for each of the credits. And I believe we have one bill on both in the Senate and on the House side. So we actually have 2 bills for each of the credits. And the idea is it just has a standard 6-year sunset extension. So that gives the vehicle for, within which the legislature can work if they want to extend that sunset. Again, they cannot pass the legislation that allows it a sunset or make any modifications. But the way that's worked in the past is, and it appears to be working this legislative session as well, is those bills are first sent from the desk to the policy committee that might have some relation of what the tax credit is. Policy committee will review that, and then there's a subsequent that would send the measure, if it comes out of the policy committee, to either the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, the House Revenue Committee, or possibly the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures. And we've actually already started to see this process happen with, I believe we have the political contributions tax credit is being scheduled for next week in House rules. So that is underway. And one thing our office does is we'll generally, if the policy committee so chooses to invite us, we'll go to the policy committee and share the information within the report and give a little background to the members as well on those committees. So in terms of the report, the general layout, there's an introduction. It gives a little background, a lot of what I just said in greater detail, really, of why this report exists and a little background on tax expenditures, credits, and also some information similar to what you just heard from the Department of Revenue as well in how to view tax expenditures or tax credits, and especially trying to narrow down, again, continue with the conversation, from that really large number of this is the total amount of revenue loss because of these tax expenditures, down to something smaller of, well, these are within maybe the policy realm of what's generally discussed. And again, there's no necessarily right way to do that, but it's to try to help in that discussion of certainly, yeah, there's a property tax exemption for state and local property, but let's put that aside and narrow down at the other ones, the other tax expenditures. And this report, of course, is only the tax credits that are scheduled to sunset. So that really is more that select group. From there is a section on each of the expiring tax credits. It has the description of it and then the policy purpose. Again, as I said earlier, the policy purpose, if the purpose is contained in statute, sometimes that is the case, but in most cases there is no policy purpose that's explicit in statute. So the way we get to that in the report is to do some background and investigative work in what was discussed during the committee at the time. And that's usually our best indication. This is what the members were talking about when they were discussing the measure. This is what perhaps the proponents or those that introduced the measure were saying we expect it to do, or this is why it needs to exist, or something to that extent. So we try to lay that out, and you'll find that it's bolded in each section to be able to draw your attention to what is the policy purpose. And from there, that really drives then the next steps of the report. We talk about who's benefiting from it, both directly, who's claiming the credit, and then possibly indirectly. And similar incentives available in Oregon. So this is where we actually work with the Legislative Fiscal Office, and they provide information on direct spending programs that have been identified to have some link to the tax credit. And the idea there is just to give an opportunity to try to view, well, here we have a tax credit that's supposed to do some sort of outcome, whether it's economic development or social policy or something to that effect. Do we have a spending program that also has some similar overlap that should be viewed or possibly viewed together? And that's why we include that information in the report. And then the credit effectiveness and efficiency, again, that's starting with this is the identified policy purpose. And then the next step is to try to explain the credit, how does it work, and how does that tie in with the policy purpose? But it really drives back to that policy purpose as the starting point. And then there's also inclusion of an analysis or description of possibly a direct appropriation, how that would work in light or in instead of the credit, admin and compliance costs, and then in some cases what other states are doing as well, if they have similar credits or something of that nature. And then the two things that are in the, or two appendices included, would be the legislative history of each of the tax credits going back from when they're enacted, and then any other changes going forward, and then also a comparison of past estimates with actual revenue impacts. And that's in response to House Bill 3542 of 2015 that requires Legislative Revenue Office to, more or less the idea there is to try to true up the estimates that were made related to a credit with what we've actually seen take place in this case, tax year 2016, because that's the most recent year in which we have information. So it's try to see what we thought it was going to cost X, what is the actual cost when people start claiming this on their return. So we try to true up those figures there. So again, the last slide I have for you here is the list of the 9 expiring tax credits. The way to read this chart is the first part is I have a list of all the tax credits, but you have the cost under current law. So again, that includes the sunset. So that's what you see right now under current law, and that's why you see in 2017-19, you might see the full cost of the credit. By 1921, you're now seeing about half of that, because these credits are expiring after 2019 to be the last tax year. So they're expiring midway through the biennium, so to speak. And then there might be a tail of some of these revenue impacts in later years, and that's usually going to be because of an allowance of a carry forward of unused credit amounts. So you'll see a revenue impact in later years, but it tends to drop off. And then the cost to extend, again, would just be simply moving that sunset date out another 6 years. So just making no policy changes to the credit and just simply extending the sunset. And that just gives kind of a starting point from which to think of how much would it cost if all we do is just move that sunset date out later but make no other changes. And that gives you a sense, and then the different bienniums, how much that would cost going forward. But again, that's an overview of the report. We have it up in OLS, and it will be on LRO's website as well shortly. So it'll be there under our publications as well.
Kyle or Chris, a question about the math here on this page. One of the theories here is to get the Tax Expenditure Committee to use the same kind of discipline as the Ways and Means folks. Ways and Means folks actually have hard numbers they have to hit, and they have to make hard choices. You know, for example, two good programs, they have to pick one or the other or reduce them in half. And so we've always operated on the Tax Credit or Tax Expenditure Committee to say, okay, give somebody, Ways and Means people, the House and Senate leadership, give us a number so that we can apply that same discipline, because without it, then these are all good things and we should do it all. So we're going to get that number, but I'm just wondering, because of the way you have this here, it looks like these credits total about $131 million per biennium, but then we're only using 1 year for 1921 or 21, 23, what number should we aim for? The full biennial or half? Or you can see why there's some confusion there where we should come in the neighborhood of,
Mr. Chair, so the cost to extend is probably the number to key off of. And that would be, so if Ways and Means or wherever the number that that can be spent, so to speak, on these tax credits is given, if it was the biennial number from 1921 was $68 million, that would be the exact amount needed to extend these out through at least that the first part of that biennium. And that's, I guess, the way to start from, where it's like, well, what would it cost? What would need to be allocated through the budget process, or what number would be needed? In the 1921 biennium, it'd be $68 million. In 21-23, it'd be $140.6 million. It would have to be that number, I suppose, received by the revenue committees. In which to just simply extend these based upon the estimates that we have today.
Okay. Senator Riley?
So that's, in my opinion, half of what it costs. I mean, because if you look at the second year out, a second biennium out, I think that's really the number you look at, because we're already spending that $68 million in 1921, because it hasn't expired yet, and so that's already in the budget. It's already being used. That's what it costs, but the actual cost shows up in the second biennium.
That's why I was confused. What is the number to use there?
The tax credit sunset in the middle of the biennium. So the first year is already baked into the revenue forecast, but the second year is not.
Okay. Second year is the full cost.
Right. So going by the numbers there, under the cost under current law for 1921, the $67.1 million cost of these credits is already embedded in the current law forecast that we're looking at.
Oh.
But now if you bounce over to the cost to extend the 1921, the $68 million is not. Is not in the current law forecast.
As the next biennium is also not in the current law.
Yeah, at that point forward, yes. That's why the numbers in the biennium that we're talking about are always give or take half of the full biennium, because the tax credits sunset in the middle of the biennium. Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions?
A comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. I want to say 2 years ago, it was $41 million or something was the budget. And we spent an enormous amount of time on that $41 million. I'm just saying. And all out of whack when compared to what Ways and Means, they spend $41
million. Yeah, before breakfast.
But wait, before breakfast, and right. Somebody sneezes and they spend, right?
Yeah.
So seems to me when they tell us what our budget is, we should figure out some way not to spend 5 months arguing over whatever they give us.
Yeah.
And I'm serious, because it really becomes a huge time sink over. It's hugely important to the people that come in, but we gotta sit down and think seriously about limiting the time we spend on this.
Thank you. We, some paperwork showed up here on bill introductions. Chris, you want to give us a quick summary on what they are?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are three LC drafts. First one, 3495, is the one that would move ballot measure or measures 5 and 50 out of the Constitution. And this is the one the chair mentioned the other day.
Needs to go back to the drawing board.
Right. So we'll get an amendment that pulls out the measure 5, or you could not.
Let's, you know what? I think it would be better to just do a new LC.
Okay. So then we're down to two LCs to be introduced. 3496 would create a refundable credit, personal income tax credit, against for contributions to 529 accounts. And 3546 can be, I think, fairly described as a technical issue. There was a mailing issue raised by the Oregon Tax Court about filing a complaint and expanding statute to accommodate technologies other than the U.S. mail.
All right. I'll open up a work session for a possible introduction of committee measures. You all know the deal that these support to introduce does not mean support for the policy itself. Senator Benz?
I move. Do I need to read those on? Chair, I move LC 3496, dated 115-019, as a committee bill. Is that adequate?
We do both.
And, Mr. Chair, I also move LC 3546, dated 116-019, as a committee bill.
Okay. Senator Benz moves to introduce as committee bills LC 3546 and LC 3496. Discussion? Objections? See none. Those two bills are introduced. That's all the business we have. We'll see you next week on Tuesday when we have some bills 78, 79, 81 to take up. Until then, we are adjourned.
Are you going to tell